This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it is my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On 12th of October 2010, our guest was Professor Victoria Chick of University College London, who spoke about her recent paper, The Economic Consequences of Mr. Osborne, to which I gave a response. You can download slides to accompany the talks from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
This paper was written jointly with Anne Pettifer, who is an activist, a wonderful person who is right on top of current events all the time, and who also knows a lot of people who are very good with data, which was extremely helpful to us, and they all declined to be thanked, which I'm rather sorry about. So it's not a sole effort. As I said, I've given you in the handout the data that we're using for the main part of the paper, so that you can refer to it if you want, and I'll explain to you exactly how to use it, if you like, when we talk about a couple of episodes. But the point of the paper is to ask the question whether it's possible to cut a deficit by intention. Now, if you read the newspapers, Financial Times even, you'll see deficit cutters being opposed to postponers of deficit cutting. And I would argue that that's a false dichotomy and misses the point, because you can't, the government can't, entirely control its own deficit. Those of you who are used to doing macroeconomics know that macroeconomics is the study of feedback relationships in the economy as a whole. And what the government does, or what the government intends to happen, is moderated and modified by the actions of everyone else in the economy. So that the deficit is the outcome not only of what the government does, but what everyone else in society does. So that dichotomy between deficit cutters and postponers is a false one. Rather, I think the appropriate dichotomy is between those who want to cut expenditure and those who are advocates at this point in time of a stimulus to the economy, who argue that the recovery from the financial crisis is precarious and that the level of unemployment is too high as it is, and there is no point, in fact, quite the opposite, in doing something which is likely to raise the level of unemployment. So they say that expenditure by government will stimulate the private sector, will employ people, and that this will have multiplier effects on the economy toward recovery, and that expenditure cutters are cutting back an inflow of income into the economy. The private sector will react by shrinking its output and employment and send the economy into a double-dip recession. That's the popular phrase, and you understand exactly what I mean. So there's a clear dichotomy of views here. But to argue that one wants to cut the deficit is a little bit misguided, because, as I say here, cutting the deficit is not in the government's control. So what Anne and I did was to look at a wide range of data, beginning in 1909, to see what happened when government expenditure expanded or retrenched. What happened to our proxy for the deficit, which is the debt to GDP ratio. And the I'll give you the results very, very shortly. But just before I do, perhaps I ought to give you some notion of where I'm headed. After I give you the main results, which you also have in your handout, I'll talk about the data and why we've omitted transfer payments. And I'll talk about a couple of periods. And then how we handled the material after the Second World War, and finally get back to the question of transfer payments. That's if I can manage all that in the time I have available.
Well, thank you, plenty.
But that's my ambitious plan. We'll see how we go. Now, this graph, which you have in your possession, is the key result of what we've done. It relates the percentage changes of government expenditure on the horizontal axis, the word government should be inserted there, to the percentage change in the debt to GDP ratio, again, look at insertion please, over particular periods of time. Now, these periods, which are indicated on the graph, and the dots are quite faint, but you can, I think, make them out. They're very close to the line, which every economist loves to see. In fact, we were astounded. but you will see that these periods are of varying length. And I'll explain how we constructed them in a minute. The extraordinary thing is that with the exception of the two world wars, they are so very close to the line, and that line has a negative slope. That is to say, every time expenditure expands, the debt-to-GDP ratio falls, and every time that expenditure is cut back, the debt-to-GDP ratio rises. This is exactly the opposite of what the present government is predicting will happen. The reason for it, I've already suggested, is the feedback relations in the rest of the economy, that if expenditure rises, this is a stimulus to the economy, income increases, the tax take increases, and the deficit or the debt ratio, which is our proxy for it, reduces as a result. And in periods of retrenchment, this sends the economy into recession, the tax take falls, and the result is that the deficit, instead of being cut, ends up rising. So that's our result, and it's very neat. I mean, even the two world wars provide something of an instruction. I mean, the First World War, of course, the expenditure was, the percentage change in expenditure was vast, but so also was the effect on the debt-to-GDP ratio. The Second World War, which followed Keynes's advice of keeping the interest rate down to 3%, was effected with far less cost to the economy. It's just, that's an aside. But the main thing is this line and these lovely little data points which are so close to it. It's a quite powerful result, and we love it, but there are questions you could raise about it and problems with it, perhaps. For people who like these sort of things, there's the regression. Any regression with an R-squared of 0.98 should be mistrusted, but I won't elaborate on that any further. It just is.
I'm worried about the minus sign.
No, you shouldn't be. It's to say that, you know, if you cut expenditure, that raises the debt, and if you lower it, it goes the other way. So that's it's the counterintuitive result that is the backbone of what this paper is all about. So I've been right up front with our result. I've put the conclusion before in front of the paper, if you like, to get it out of the way. in some sense, or to impress it upon you, or something like that. I have a few notes on the data sources. Of course, the data from the Office of National Statistics doesn't go back as far as we would like, so I've used the marvelous work of Charles Feinstein to push it back as far as we have done. But the most important thing to notice about these data is that we've used final consumption and fixed capital formation of central and local government. We haven't included any transfer payments. Now, there's a very good reason for our choosing to do that. It is expenditure that's a direct stimulus to the economy. And transfers are movements of money around from one group of people in the economy to another, and sometimes to people abroad. And therefore, the effect of transfer payments on the macroeconomy is indirect. Suppose that we take as a rule of thumb, it's quite reasonable to do so, that benefit payments involve a transfer from the better off to the less well off. And you would expect the better off to have a fairly low marginal propensity to consume in comparison to the worse off. So that this transfer of resources to the less well off might raise consumption and economic activity generally. But that effect is indirect in comparison to the direct effect of government expenditure, which just immediately puts new income into the economy. The other element of transfers, which is important, I'm getting ahead of my story and I'll stop myself. The other element which is important is interest payments on the government debt, servicing of the government debt. There you might expect the opposite kind of transfer from, if not the worst off, at least middlingly well off, to the better off and to foreigners. So these two elements of transfers work in opposite directions, but the main point here for the main body of the paper is that their effect is indirect. And so we took them out and we didn't treat them in the version of the paper which is currently on the web at all, but we decided to look at them, and what we found was extremely interesting. And I think it's worth both cracking out transfers in general and breaking transfers down to these two important components. We measured public debt as a percentage of GDP mostly from the Treasury website and, of course, again, from Feinstein. The other data, which appear in the paper, but I probably won't talk about as much as I might like, come from, again, the ONS, Feinstein, the Treasury, and a book on the history of interest rates by Homer and Silla, a fascinating compendium, which I recommend to all of you. Now, let me see, just a minute. Okay. Something happened in the preparation of data, and I can't put up my 1918 to 23 data, so you're actually forced to look at your data, and I'm forced to look at it too. But this was the period marked by the end of the First World War, which was discussed on the radio this morning. If you didn't hear it at 9 o'clock this morning, you can hear it again at 9:30 on Radio 4. Skidelsky was one of the participants, one of the most sensible of them, I might say. It was known as the period of the Geddes Axe. Geddes was asked to formulate reasons for her formulate methods by which the then government of Lloyd George could bring the deficit down. Today's radio program suggested that the main reason, political reason, for doing this was to bring taxation down, and the only way to bring taxation down was to bring expenditure down. I think it was only Skidelsky who managed to mention the word exchange rates. Now, let me put this in some kind of context, because Skidelsky has got the right end of the stick. The gold standard continued de jure throughout the First World War, but de facto convertibility was impossible. Britain was still on the gold standard, therefore, at the end of the First World War. And it was part of the thinking at the time that the gold standard was somehow sacrosanct, not to Keynes, but and not to Reginald McKenna and a few other people. I mean, there is a handful of people who question this. But for the rest of the economics establishment in Britain, it was an absolutely hard and fast fact that the gold standard was the core of Britain's success as an economy. For Keynes, it was the other way around. Britain's success as an economy was the foundation of a successful gold standard, and he was, I think, right. But, you know, he was outweighed by this tremendous unanimity of opinion that the gold standard must be returned to, and must be returned to at the pre-war parity. I mean, people didn't think about devaluation in those days. You know, this country's been through quite a lot of them since then, and we know how to do it. Was it Harold Wilson that said, "I didn't know we could do that"? Something like that in his devaluation. Well, certainly, at this time, at the end of the First World War, nobody knew they could do that. Nobody even imagined such a cataclysmic step as a devaluation. It was ruled out of court. However, the difficulty in returning to the gold standard at the pre-war parity was that prices rose like rockets in the First World War and were out of line with Britain's main trading partners. So the purpose of deflation, I believe, and it seemed to me from this morning Skidelsky also believes, was to bring prices down, not to bring taxes down, but to bring prices down, to collapse to the point where pre-war parity was a sustainable proposition. Now, you probably know that even in 1925, when Britain did go back on the gold standard at the pre-war parity, there was a little disparity of prices, about 10%, and it caused a lot of trouble, and the gold standard didn't last very long. But at the end of the First World War, the price disparity was much greater than that. And and so the policy was to deflate the economy on purpose. Keynes, remarking on the Cunliffe Committee, which met in which produced its first interim report in 1918, remarked that the Cunliffe Committee cheerfully spelt out exactly how the deflationary impacts that they recommended would have their effect, and these included causing mass unemployment. Geddes followed that up, sort of made the tactical suggestions after Cunliffe's strategic program, and as you can see from your big screed of data, if you look at 1918, which ought to be in bold, and I'll explain that in a minute. If you look from 1918 to 1923, public expenditure went down like a lead balloon. I mean, it was really quite extraordinary. And public debt went up. That's the fourth column. Public debt went up. Interest rates were hardly affected at all. Unemployment rocketed, penultimate column there. And the GDP deflator, the price index we've used here, went from something rather strongly positive to something rather strongly negative. So it served the purpose for which it was intended. They got the prices down at the cost of a very substantial level of unemployment. And, of course, if you look in the second column, am I going too fast? Are you okay? Some of you aren't looking at all, which means you're listening up, I suppose. Nominal GDP also fell quite substantially. But that's a classic example of how deflation can bring prices down. Yes, okay, if that's what you want to do, but the mechanism by which it does it is through unemployment. Now, the reason that 1918 was in bold is that we've used turning point years every time the fiscal stance as measured by government expenditure changes direction, rises, falls, and delineates our periods. We've included the beginning and ending year in both the previous period and the subsequent one. And so you can spot the periods which correspond, or they ought to correspond, I hope to goodness they correspond, with the graph, with those emboldened lines in your table of data. The same thing happens in 1931, which I think I have got data for. So you don't have to peer in the gloom. I've complained about the lights in this room before. you can actually see them on the screen if Mark and I get our heads out of the way. That's a very short period, but again, not as sharp, nothing like as sharp, but it's a period of cutting back public expenditure, and you see that the public debt to GDP ratio rises, and that nominal GDP falls. Unemployment by this time, this is the depth of the Depression, was already catastrophic, and it isn't doing very much. It's rocking around 21, 22, 20. You know, it's just dire. And so don't even look there. And you had a price deflation again. I'm concentrating on these austerity periods because I think they may be the most important ones at the moment. And if you just have a look at the data that's in your possession, you can trace very easily what happens in the other periods when there's expansion. I'm repeating myself now. Here's one that was spelt out. I had another plan at some stage where public expenditure rises and rises very considerably. And you find the public debt ratio falling and unemployment still dire, but marginally improving. That's the story. Now, when you get to, and you might say, well, what's the point of all this old stuff? The main point of the old stuff is that it's extremely clear-cut, that you do have periods where public expenditure goes up, followed by periods when it goes down in absolute terms. After the Second World War, things are much harder to handle, much fuzzier. And we have these ridiculously long periods, two of them to cover the whole of the period since the Second World War. Public expenditure in money terms never goes down after the Second World War. Prices don't go down either. So the only way of differentiating our two periods is really what is happening to real deflation, if you like, or inflation. And what we found is that you can differentiate that a little bit, that after 1976, this is scattered all over the place for some reason. It's not translated to your configuration terribly well, but I pretend that all of the figures to the right of this line are in a line with one another, and the same is true of all the figures to the left. That's easy enough. After 1976, real expenditure tails off, and even nominal expenditure is pretty flat, whereas in the earlier years, government expenditure grows a bit faster. For some reason, we have government I know what the point of this is. Government expenditure as a percentage of GDP is virtually the same, but its real growth was greater in the earlier period. And 1976 in this country, of course, marks the appeal to the IMF to help us out of our dire budgetary difficulties, as they were called. So that's the only demarcation we have for the very long period since the Second World War. Things are not as clear-cut, but they do tell us some important things. In the expansionary period, you have the change in the public debt falling a bit, and in the more miserly period since 1976, it goes up a minute amount. Growth is slower in the miserly second half, and unemployment is substantially higher. Interest rates were high all the time in nominal terms, but in real terms, they've been much higher since 1976 than they were before. Can you see all right? You're sort of scrunching around.
I can see the last number.
Sorry, yes.
Yes. There we go. Okay.
Using every inch of the screen.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So that's the story after the end of the Second World War. Now, and it's not as colourful a story as the story before the Second World War, but it's still instructive, I think. I'm going to leave that. Let us put government debt in perspective. You know, you have heard on the BBC people saying something like, oh, the country's in the most terrible position, we have all this debt. Well, you know, that's where we are. yes, it has risen since 2007, but when you consider where we've been, doesn't seem quite so horrendous as it's portrayed by the present government. This is, of course, a war. There's peak here, and so is that. Now, you can see that it was much easier to bring debt down after the Second World War than after the First. There's a very good reason for that. In 1917, there was a big debt issue, war loan, paying 5%. And it was a huge proportion of the total of government debt. And it dominated the entire post-First World War scene until it was possible to renegotiate its terms. It was entirely legal, but it was rather unusual. After Britain left the gold standard in 1931, and that's what you have here, where I'm pointing to the peak, that was the year of the consolidation of 5% war loan into a loan of at 3.5%. And so then the debt, the general level of debt goes down. But until then, it was the anticipation of going back to the gold standard plus maintaining the gold standard, which meant that you couldn't lower interest rates on government debt without having a flight from sterling. So that's why the debt ratio stayed up for that long period after the First World War. The Second World War was the 3% war, as I told you before, and the debt was not quickly run off, 20 years, but steadily run off, and has stayed at this level with a few bumps and things until recently. And this little area here is what is causing the present hysteria. Now, I just have a few further points to make. This general point about spending I have made so many times already, but I think it's probably worth summarizing that discussion, which I'll do in the form of two quotations from your favorite author. And then I want to talk about transfers and a little bit about interest rates, and then I'm finished. Two quotations here. One which I owe, in fact, to Jesper, who found it in an obscure corner of the collected writings of Keynes, lost it, and spent a whole afternoon finding it again. Oh yes, it's all true. That's the way research is done. But it's one of the best quotations for the present purpose that you could possibly ask for. Look after the unemployment and the budget will look after itself. What does that mean? It means that to concentrate on cutting the deficit is to look at the problem through the wrong end of the telescope. What you ought to be doing is looking at the health of the economy, and when the economy is healthy, the deficit more or less disappears. Not the debt, but the deficit. And the debt ratio will fall. But what this government is doing is looking at the deficit and not sort of noticing that there might be repercussions on employment that follow its actions. And the second quotation, equally good, but not due to Jesper this time, maybe it is in your book, I don't know. For the proposition that supply creates its own demand, I shall substitute the proposition that expenditure creates its own income. So those are the kinds of messages that I think are important to notice in the present climate, and they were important in 1933, really the depth of the recession, when there were still people trying to argue that government expenditure was injurious to the economy. Now, here are the data from 1947. We haven't gone back to earlier periods, because we just can't. Indicating how much of total government expenditure, that is to say, general government expenditure, GGE, consists of the measure that I've been talking about up to now, general government final consumption and investment, and how much is transfers. And you can see that expenditure as a percentage of GDP has been remarkably stable. Well, we had that data before. Transfers have gone up quite a lot, and they are a very substantial portion of the total. Most of the commentators that you hear or read will always cite the GGE figure If it's up close to 40%, or it's around 40%, that's what they're quoting. It includes transfers. Now, I've explained to you our reasoning in not including transfers in the initial material and treating them separately. And, oh dear, I hope this is readable. Oh, yes, it should be, I guess. I think you can ignore the total pretty much, except to notice that there's a bit of a rise, and certainly since 1949 there is, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the really interesting thing is that debt interest payments, which is this pink line here, look at it. Everyone's complaining about the fact that interest rates may rise if we don't cure the deficit, and they're actually falling. Whereas the main element of transfer payments since 1949, where they've been rising steadily, is other, which is benefits, essentially. Now, here you have the First World War, okay, 1914 is around here somewhere, and then with the 1917 war loan, interest payments soar up 5%. 5%, you know, was a tremendous interest rate in those days. And it stays up again until 1931 or 2. It should be 32, but anyway, when the debt was converted, and then the interest payments fall, and they've been at this roughly same level ever since. The benefit payments have risen, and that you can see here that the extent of social benefits as a proportion of GDP has gone up very steadily. After the war. So all those indirect effects that I talked about come into play when you look at those two elements of transfer payments. And if anything, the transfer payments during the period between the wars, which was a devastating period in this country, indicated that most of the transfers would have been inimical to macroeconomic activity and growth. Since the end of the Second World War, probably transfer payments stimulate growth on the whole. Interest payments have fallen to a fairly low level. So that feature of post-war economics needs a much more thorough examination when you have people arguing about whether the tax regime or the benefit regime is regressive or progressive. It's really quite important. And the interest payment argument is not as nearly as important as everybody makes out. It's quite plain. Then this should be number three. Then the final thing I want to talk about is the whole area of interest rates and monetary policy, which these are things that are going on while these other cuts are being or expansions are being experienced. But what we found was that high debt was not particularly associated with high interest. Interest rates really are determined by other factors than the scale of the government debt, it seems. The idea that the markets might suddenly call a halt and say, we're not going to buy your debt, or we'll only buy it at exorbitant interest rates, is not a phenomenon that's been seen yet. I'm not saying it isn't going to happen, but it hasn't been seen yet. Most importantly, from 1932 until the end of the Dalton experiment in 1952, policy was aimed at keeping the long-term rate of interest as low as could possibly be managed. I've already mentioned the 3% war and the conversion of war loan, and other policies followed the same track and kept interest rates down. Now, those of you who've studied Keynes's theory of investment will be sure to recognize that he argued that low rates of interest would stimulate investment and investment would stimulate the economy, and high rates of interest would inhibit investment, and a low volume of investment was deleterious for the economy, because investment was the autonomous element in spending, that part which could be stimulated without a rise in income and by itself give rise to an increase in income. So this was Keynes's idea, for sure, carried on for a short period after his death in 1946 by Hugh Dalton, and then abandoned. In America, there was something called the Treasury Federal Reserve Accord, that is, they agreed to let interest rates go up, and the same thing happened here. And the other feature of monetary policy in tight corners, when unemployment was high and government wished to spend, is that government found various ways of financing their expenditure. In effect, getting around the cap on the money supply by inventing — there was a chap called Bradbury who invented them, which is why they bear his name — inventing a form of money which fell outside those strictures. Treasury deposit receipts forced the banks to lend to government at very low rates of interest, and what I've called QE1, early quantitative easing, in which the Bank of England would freely buy government debt and manage government debt in such a way as to keep interest rates down. And when that wasn't feasible, they simply lent to government. It was called lending by ways and means advances. And those in the interwar period were quite prominent. Now, we are constrained by EU regulation not to do these sorts of fiddles. But they were very effective fiddles, which kept interest rates down and kept government debt freely flowing when expansion was deemed necessary for macroeconomic reasons. Well, that's our story. There's more to it. I mean, charts of rates of unemployment and things like that, and you can look at the paper on the website and it will be shortly updated. But the basic story is a very simple one, actually, falling in two parts: the major part about government expenditure being effective as a stimulus to the economy, and the second, more complex part about transfer payments, and then these other background issues of interest rates and monetary policy supporting government when government expenditure is deemed appropriate, which were well in place in the interwar period when government was allowed to use them after 1931, but which have fallen into disrepair, shall we say, or desuetude — I love that word — and in fact were finally abolished in the Maastricht Treaty with the European Union. They can't be used anymore. So government is much more constrained in what it can do than it once was.
That's it?
That's it.
Thank you very much indeed. That's great. Well, if I could borrow the mouse.
Yes.
What I'd like to do is respond briefly by playing devil's advocate. Not my usual role.
Oh, really?
When it comes to Vicky Chick. But
Poor me. Well, I actually can't.
But what I want to do is just briefly outline the main conclusions of one of the papers that seems to be lying behind George Osborne's thinking on economics, on the budget. And
incidentally, if you don't know why the paper has the title it has, you need to bone up on your Keynes. We won't tell them, will we?
The Economic Consequences of Mr. Churchill, of course. Yes, which was a...
Bringing Britain back onto the gold standard in 25.
So, I mean, Vicky has given us, if you like, the very long view on this subject from a Keynesian, a post-Keynesian perspective. This is the view that's current, and as I say, is informing people like Andrew Lillico, who is the chief economist of Think Tank Policy Exchange, which appears to have written the script, really, for George Osborne on the question of how to deal with the deficit and how to deal also with the recession. So as you can see, Alberto Alessino, he's been writing for about 20 years on this subject, he coined the concept of the expansionary fiscal contraction, or, as he prefers to put it, expansionary fiscal adjustment. In other words, the idea that cutting the deficit will actually boost the economy. So that's a polar opposite, if you like, of Keynesian ideas. And this paper contains three figures in it, which, if I can find the right page.
Oh, gosh.
Aha, uh-huh, there we go. It worked. This takes a bit of explanation, so bear with me if I'm not sitting in front of it. This is obviously his graph, not mine. But what he's trying to show with this graph is the difference between the effect of fiscal policy on his definitions, first of all, on the economy. So, and we probably don't need to worry too much about all the columns to the right of the screen. If you just concentrate on the two columns which are in pair, have a pair on the extreme left. This one is called primary expenditure, and this one is called total revenue. They can probably not see the heading. So what this is arguing is that in the black columns relate to expansionary episodes, in other words, where fiscal stimulus led to expansion, and the white column is denotes episodes which were contractionary. So his basic result here. So that he argues that fiscal policy is successful, so it's the black column, when 71% of the stimulus comes from tax cuts, okay, is that bit, and 29% comes from expenditure growth. And it's unsuccessful, and that's the white column, in situations where expenditure is leading. So in this case, he finds that 117% of the fiscal boost, in other words, more than the amount of the extra deficit, if that comes from expenditure, and revenue, in fact, reduces the deficit, so taxes are increased, spending rises, taxes are increased, then on his reading of the results, this leads to a contractionary episode. So this is very hard to
get across. I hope I'm just getting the basic flavour to you. So what he's arguing is that fiscal policy works through tax cuts, not through spending increases. The second point he makes is that when you look at this is the opposite situation where we are at the moment, if you like. Fiscal adjustment means cuts, okay? So fiscal policy on the...
Fiscal consolidation does too. Yeah.
So what he's saying here is that if you look at expansionary episodes, fiscal contractions lead to expansionary episodes, that's the black column here, where 86% of the adjustment is on spending and 13% is on tax. And if you do it the other way and you have a majority of it coming from tax adjustments, two-thirds, one-third basically, in favour of tax or against tax, if you like. Tax rises as a method of closing the deficit will lead to a contractionary episode. And then in his third figure, and this is the one which is of the most interest to the government, I think, they argue that this is distinguished between successful and unsuccessful episodes, and that's successful in terms of the debt to GDP ratio, okay, the overall ratio of debt, government debt. They argue that successful episodes are characterized by an adjustment of 135% of the change in the primary deficit on the spending side, 35%. I mean, tax actually makes a negative contribution. In other words, tax take falls, but that leads to a successful outcome, whereas the unsuccessful outcomes, again, it's roughly the two-thirds, one-third split that attempts to make the adjustment by placing two-thirds of the emphasis on tax cuts and only one-third on spending cuts are unsuccessful in reducing the debt burden. I hope that's half clear. And obviously I'm trying to do injustice in terms of the opposite view on this. Now, at this stage, it's a bit of a puzzle to me why you get such different results. And of course, there's no theory here, really. This is just an econometric study. As far as I can see, and this is where I start to come back to you, Vicky, there's a lot of it has to do with definition. I mean, Alessina's sample is all the OECD countries, all the major ones. It's only the post-Bretton Woods era years from 1917. So those are two significant issues. They adopt very selective, if I may say so, or very special, shall we say, measures of what constitutes an expansion in terms of output and a success in terms of debt reduction. All these figures are based not on, as yours were, nominal expenditure and the debt ratio. These are all done as a percentage of GDP. So, in particular, the primary deficit, the government expenditure, is expressed as a percentage of GDP, which rings a big warning bell for me, since obviously the changes in GDP are
part of the outcome.
Yes, exactly. This does have to do with your theory of how the macroeconomy works. But I'm not clear yet how critical that is to his result. It's interesting that his definition of primary expenditure includes transfers, whereas yours doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of of fiscal stimulus concentrates on the primary deficit. I mentioned the word primary deficit. In other words, he corrects for the automatic stabilizers, the cyclical effects on fiscal policy. So as Giuseppe Fontana, our colleague, has pointed out, you know, a large part of fiscal policy is represented by that, and therefore taking it out of the picture seems a fairly drastic way of going about things. I mean, obviously his intention is to concentrate or to isolate the discretionary parts of fiscal policy, but whether that's a valid methodology is a big question for me.
Can I interrupt with a point of information?
Yes.
Or possibly just to give myself a breather from trying to walk on my head. I mean, the world does seem a little bit upside down, but they include transfers in expenditure.
Yeah.
And adjust for stabilizers at what point? Because you see, it seems they're putting it in and taking them out, if you see.
Well, I'd have to.
The point about transfers is that they are typically automatic, isn't it? I mean, apart from interest rates, servicing of public debt. Following interest rate policy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, the primary deficit excludes interest. Okay.
All right.
But it's defined as primary expenses other than interest minus total revenue, and is also, and the expenses component of that is cyclically adjusted primary expenditure as a share of GDP equals transfers plus government wage expenditures, government non-wage expenditures, subsidies and government investment, all as a percentage of income, GDP.
I don't get it.
So we've got a bit of homework to do, I think, to try and reconcile these different approaches to the data, let alone anything else. But in fact, that was all I wanted to say about that paper, though it does. There was one question that then emerged for me in response to yours. And this is a difficult question politically, which is, does your paper actually support deficit reduction through cutting benefits? In other words, is the main engine of debt reduction actually the employment that's created directly by the direct expenditure? And that does the evidence support the idea that transfers could be cut in order to balance the books without suffering from this self-defeating problem that you've pointed out?
Golly, Mark, I'm very grateful to you for struggling with this article, because it baffles me, I have to say. It takes a long time to get inside anybody else's work, but this seems more difficult than most.
Yeah.
And I hope mine wasn't quite as difficult. The man behind you shook his head. I'm so pleased. Thank you very much. But to make this attempt, I think, is really very brave indeed, and may even be productive in the end. I hope so, for your sake. Well, I think that it doesn't support a program of cutting benefit, because benefits, on the whole, are expansionary. If you take the argument about differential marginal propensities to consume, they're a redistributive device. But they should have a net expansionary effect on the economy, so cutting them ought to be deflationary. It depends quite how you cut them, of course. And since they're not being cut across the board but differentially, well, it depends how far they go or how far they're allowed to go. But I think in general, it doesn't. I mean, it seems to me that the automatic stabilizers in this country work extremely well in that function. They do stabilize, they do work. We've done a little preliminary skirmish with US data which show that the reaction of the debt ratio to changes in expenditure is a little less marked, and we think that that's because the automatic stabilizers are not so strong, but we don't know really. I mean, we haven't gone into that. So, you know, since benefits are a large part of the automatic stabilizer, large part of the automatic stabilizer story, it seems to me that they're important. Now, clearly there's a lot of work that needs to be done on their indirect effects. We don't know anything really about those. So I wouldn't want to be, you know, definitive, but it doesn't seem to me that that's an implication. May I make a point that I saw very clearly, and I'm sure you've seen it too, but just to make sure you have seen it, we didn't look at taxes at all. We looked at expenditure, we didn't look at taxes. And they are part of any kind of budgetary policy. But again, government can't determine the tax revenue that they get. They can set tax rates, but they can't determine the tax take. Right? So again, it's out of their control to some extent. And also, it has a more muted effect, it has a lower multiplier than government expenditure has. But it is a missing component. And compared to this, that shows quite importantly. The reason that we didn't include it is precisely because of this feedback loop, and the data only give you the outcome, so it will not give you the policy, whereas on expenditure you can be pretty sure that if government wants to spend, it can do it. And its intentions are realized. With taxes, you can't be sure in that way. And so your data are always ex post. They always include everything that's happened to contribute to them. And that's true of the deficit. It's true of the tax take. So we left that aside. But I can't say anything about 30-70 or anything like that, because we didn't look at the tax take.